Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Folks, welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast. You've got Mark here. Well, we had Cal Cresti back on the show. If you haven't heard of Cal or you don't know of the work that he's done, he was a federal negotiator for a very long time for the federal police in Canada and negotiated with terrorist groups, hostage situations. He's sort of been there, done that. And now what he's doing is he's doing cyber negotiations. So what ends up happening is these large transnational crime syndicates take data hostage, essentially, of large law firms, accounting firms, etc. And he goes in and negotiates to release the data, which I think is just wild. And he uses a lot of the hostage negotiation skills that he's developed over his career to do that. Fascinating discussion, as always. You're going to love it. Enjoy this wonderful chat with Cal Cresti. Cal, how are you?
Very well, Mark. Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm splendid, man. I'm stoked to have you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
Well, I know you pretty well, I think, but for the listeners who don't know you and don't know what you do, the extensive experience that you have, maybe you could give the listeners a bit of a brief background before we dive into our subject matter today.
Okay. 33 years with the Canadian Federal Police, specializing in transnational organized crime operations and intelligence, and in the area of kidnaps, extortions, and the subsequent negotiations in those fields. Been involved in that work for 30 plus years around the world, negotiating with some of the most difficult terrorist groups and in war zones as well as doing that domestically back within Canada, dealing with conflict situations, as well as with police hostage negotiation teams. I retired 2 years ago and transitioned into Ventus Global and the critical risk team, doing consulting in a number of areas relative to negotiation and conflict management. And quite often, just because of my background in the transnational organized crime world, I get asked most recently in the last 2 years to engage in today's topic, which is in cyber-related negotiations, specifically as it relates to ransomware and cyber extortion, and work with a group of collective hostage negotiators from around the world to provide education, consulting, and coaching for these type of incidents and other negotiation forums.
That's what I find so fascinating, is that data is becoming so much more important in businesses' growth and their sustainability. But at the same time, it's also becoming one of the biggest risks that a lot of businesses have. So I guess therein lies the difficulty. How do we protect our data better? And that's for the cybersecurity guys. But when our data gets compromised or when it gets held hostage, so to speak, it presents us with a really interesting challenge of how do we get that data back? Do we get that data back? Is it different than existing hostage negotiations? And so maybe I'll start there. Are there similarities in sort of cyber extortion and that kind of sort of data hostage negotiation to normal hostage negotiation work that you've done before? Are there similarities, and maybe where there are similarities, what are the differences?
Yeah, for sure. So I think, Mark, you touched on something just in the question itself when you alluded to risk. And the businesses and the law firms and insurance firms all refer to risk. But a commonality in this, and something that's super important in terms of this, as it relates to other forms of like hostage negotiation and kidnap negotiations, is it is a crime. And the context of that risk is a criminal activity and a criminal incident. And as some people refer to it as a crime in action, and with that comes a whole host of other risks that most people may not be familiar with, surface value. So that's one of the commonality. Number two, the commonality because of that, the opponents or the other party that you're negotiating with has a complete different set. When we talk about culture, that includes values, belief systems. And when it comes to negotiating with criminals, That means their values and belief systems are going to have a very different cultural perspective than most legitimate businesses there in terms of ethics and morals, in terms of a negotiation process, where a lot of people, I think they try to display that they have some ethics and some honor. There's many cases where people are betrayed and those ethics and those approaches aren't, and you have to be prepared for that, I think, in the negotiation process. The other ones, in terms of its association with kidnaps and how it connects to the cyber world, is historically, I think, you know, there's been a lot of portrayal in the media relative to lone wolves, cyber geeks engaged in this activity. But I would suggest the trend has been continual movement towards transnational organized crime networks and even states, i.e. countries, nation state threat actors that are participating in these. Thus, they are involved in the negotiation processes directly or indirectly through proxy actors. So those are some of the similarities. The other ones are obviously, and they are super obvious, is, hey, somebody's asking for money and holding something that you have and asking for something back. In that, the huge emotional element in the negotiation process in both of them, because of the high stakes, one is life and death. The other one is life and death of your company, potentially, and life and death of your reputation, which could be fatal and has significant value. There's similar tactics used, you know, in kidnappings and cybers. In terms of in kidnappings, they look for proof of life. In cyber, they're looking at proof of capacity and willingness to decrypt. And then obviously in both, they're looking at assessing the risk in terms of engaging in a negotiation process and possibly conceding something in a negotiation process. What does that equate to in terms of future risk of being a victim again of that type of behavior? And I guess the other one is the negotiations in both those, which is maybe not that obvious, is obviously with a criminal actor or threat actor, as they refer to them in cyber. But it's also, and I think we've talked about it before, and I know other speakers have spoken about it, it's also about negotiating with people on your team, i.e. in this particular case, with the C-suite executives, with the technical people and others. And those negotiations and communications in these type of crisis situations are equally challenging, complex, and critical in terms of the successful outcome of any negotiation process within cyber extortion and ransomware cases.
So there's a lot there that I want to unpack. The first thing is around the nature of risk in these types of negotiations. My assumption when I was thinking about this and researching this, my assumption when I'm comparing it to a traditional hostage negotiation, once we have the hostages back, that the risk of danger to the hostages is now removed, right? We've made the exchange for whatever it is. Hopefully we've got the hostage back without giving out too much of a concession. But I would assume in a cyber negotiation, there's still the risk of them copying that data and then now still coming back to the well, essentially, to say, hey, just kidding, we want more. How do you manage that?
Well, it's a difficult one to manage. And I think there's another complexity that's often not identified, Mark. It's a great point in the sense that, one, you can't trust criminals all the time. So you have to prepare that, you know, you can get like round two and they come around for the second round of it. But probably more concerning, just based on my experience engaging with law firms, corporations on this issue, is quite often you see it in the media and you see people with perhaps a couple of years in the cybersecurity world as it relates to negotiating with cyber criminals, that they automatically measure risk based on, well, number one, they go, the information on the other party is, you know, they're honorable in terms of the business practices. So if they say they're not going to do it, the statistical analysis shows they won't do it. Number two, they then use the second measure as they go to the dark web to see where it's possibly sold that information during the negotiation process. And then they come back to the clients and the victims and they say, we've checked, we've been monitoring it, it's not there. Well, that's true, I guess, if you're looking at criminal networks that are, you're engaged in the negotiation process. But if you're engaged in a state actor, which there's a lot of activity on, and sometimes they use criminal proxy actors and other proxy mechanisms to negotiate with. But if it's a state actor, and without mentioning any names for sensitivities here, but there's a couple of cases in North America where health agencies have been hit on cyber attacks. And, you know, some of the messaging is that there's nothing on the dark web. There's nothing in our intelligence banks to show that that data's out there. So we're all safe. It's all over. Everything was good. We paid the ransom. We did the negotiations. But if it went to the state actor, they're going to take that information, say, theoretically, if they took a country like, say, for example, Canada, and got 50% of the health data on Canadians, they may not sell it on the black market if that's a nation state. And they may hold that and leverage that for their own intelligence purposes, further extortions on individuals, on groups outside dealing with that company. And that company was, in fact, perhaps just a platform or a transition place to get to the primary objective, right? And they just went to grab that data. So in that negotiation process, I think some people look at it very linearly in terms of how the threat actors and how the other actors, what their anticipated moves are, and they think it's just financial. You know, like any other business interest, they're usually a mix of interests, and financial is definitely one in cyber cases, but there is political interest and other interests aside from that. So it's super important to just be aware, particularly with state actors.
With the growing trend of data security being of utmost importance and all of the data issues that just on the surface of the media that we as common consumers are seeing, like, for example, with TikTok and others, have you seen a trend from any specific country placing more importance on this? Or is that maybe too sensitive a question? Can you answer that? Or are you seeing more activity from a specific region?
Yeah. Well, the reporting from intelligence agencies and cyber intelligence agencies is obviously identifying, you know, two Western countries, you know, the increasing threat from China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea as threat actors, and then them using proxy mechanisms for the cyber attacks. You know, there's currently others saying that the West is doing other attacks as well, which I'm not overly familiar with, but some of the other ones have been well publicized, you know, whether it be the Sony attack by North Korea and some of the other attacks, you know, that have been publicized in the media. So I would say the state-sponsored attacks are growing. And when even talking to law firms and cyber people, I don't know if they all appreciate the sophistication and the frequency and the severity of those type of activities and their capacity in terms of doing it, which all has an impact on the negotiations processes that one takes. And that the other ones is that, you know, retrench is the focus on the healthcare research, and that obviously with COVID issues and just because of the sensitivity of the data that, you know, some of these institutions have, as well as financial institutions and critical infrastructure, particularly when you're seeing the increase in state actors, because that's the stuff that they're going to go after. And then just more sophisticated in terms of social engineering and, you know, manipulating the victim to engage and to compromise. And I would say, although not discussed, and I don't have visibility on this, I would anticipate in terms of the way the world is going in terms of geopolitically, I would anticipate more insider threats as well, you know, from nation states as well, just based on how things are evolving in the world currently.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about another company that I run called Content Callout. It is a thought leadership brand marketing company. Now, what does that mean? It means that we take you as an executive or entrepreneur, a leader of a small or medium-sized business, and we turn you into a thought leader online. We take your personal brand and we amp it up to 11. So that you can lead with confidence, knowing that people will recognize you, recognize your brand, and recognize your business because of the thought leadership approach that you've taken on social media through content creation and content distribution, as well as engaging with all of your following online. How do you get involved in this? Easy, easy, easy. Just go to contentcallout.com/get-started. And you will see there three different options that will allow you to take your thought leadership brand for yourself and for your business to the next level. We are super excited to talk to you about this. We've seen some massive growth with the businesses that we've been working with. Very, very exciting time for us. Look at that. We appreciate it. Now back to your show. One would assume that because of the nature of the crime, the criminal in this case is a significantly more sophisticated criminal. They're more intelligent, they're more educated. And my assumption is then that presents us actually with a significantly bigger problem when it comes to negotiating with that criminal. So when you start negotiating a cyber hostage or cyber extortion negotiation, and you're trying to secure the data or at least get proof of life, what would you call it in cyber hostage negotiations?
Well, we call it the proof of capacity or willingness to decrypt.
Okay. So when you're trying to figure that out, when you're approaching this type of criminal, and yes, the morals and philosophy and all that are criminal in aspect, but they are also more sophisticated. Do you approach the negotiation differently because you're making the assumption that they are more sophisticated, or does that change?
Well, they're definitely sophisticated for sure. And, you know, just like any other transnational organized crime group, and there are lone wolves that may not be, and you're, you know, it's, there's some risk in terms of overgeneralizing on it, but the level of sophistication is, you know, similar to other transnational organized crime groups. And some of these are the same groups that just shift criminal activity to escape detection and escape their own risk. So when I first started working, you know, on cartel operations a decade ago, quickly realized that these guys, through my interaction, must sit in a boardroom, must have accountants, must have business development, must have logistical considerations. And like, there's no way you can run a multi-billion dollar organization just like these cyber criminals without having very sophisticated business infrastructure and business strategies. And that includes the negotiation strategies that they use. But I've also been involved in cases where the strategy seems fairly consistent, but they pivot, you know, due to some unknown reasons, due to, you know, their own internal business model, strategy, priorities, or whatever else. I know a lot of people go in relying on intelligence companies to predict how the negotiation process is going to go. And I guess there's some good in it, but I think, you know, just like any other negotiation, Mark, you have to be dynamic, fluid, and be prepared to expect the unexpected in any type of negotiation, because it's a human at the other end that you're dealing with.
What fascinates me, and I think a lot of people don't necessarily think about this just because of the world that we live in versus the world that you live in, is when we think of criminals, we think of like basic B&E, maybe we think of murder, you know, we think of like basic crime. We don't think of like transnational organized crime. And these guys sitting in suits around a boardroom table trying to devise their global crime strategy overall. And what's fascinating for me, just from an outsider's perspective looking in, is how these groups have evolved, like regular businesses have evolved to try and incorporate data as, you know, a fundamental strength within their businesses. They are now including data as a fundamental opportunity to take advantage of within their cyber crimes. I was watching an interview with, I can't remember the podcast host, but the guest was Michael Francis. He was part of the Colombo crime family. Yeah. And very like quiet. You would swear this guy was an accountant. And it's not what I expected at all. He looked like a normal guy, accountant, but he was the upper echelons of the mafia. And he was talking about their operations back in the day. I thought to myself, I have a totally incorrect perspective of what global transnational crime looks like, because when I think of how intelligent, and these guys are super intelligent that run these organizations, when I think about how intelligent these guys are, I think a lot of us come into a negotiation probably like this. If I was the CEO or the corporate head of one of these organizations, I would come in assuming this was like a petty criminal, but they're not. They're very intelligent. They're very sophisticated, and it takes a much more nuanced approach, I would imagine, when you're negotiating with them.
Well, it does, Mark, but perhaps I'm cynical, but the reason, as you have alluded to, is the reason that they're growing partially, not completely, partially because of the technical cat and mouse race to who's ahead of who in terms of defense versus offense capabilities, in terms of the technology world, in terms of who has the better capabilities. But part of that reason that they're growing, in my humble opinion, is because of, I think, a gap in terms of the response from the communities in the negotiation field. Because if you look at it historically, these geniuses that are these technical experts in cybersecurity within our nations have like amazing hard skills, for lack of a better term, in terms of technology. But the threat is actually a human threat that requires a different skill set that includes the negotiation, the conflict management stuff, because at the other end, no matter what anybody says, the threat is a human threat, not just a technical threat. And not that one's more important than the other, but they are equally important. But when you look at it in terms of, say, kidnappings, when you compare it, do a comparative analysis of the history of kidnapping, kidnapping threats have not grown significantly. Why? I give credit to the negotiating business model in terms of the response to it, because it's just not as viably worth it, and there's more risk to it as a partial contributing to managing that rise in that type of criminal activity and that type of risk and that type of threat to corporations and individuals. I sometimes wonder, and I use the word, you know, for listeners, because I had somebody say, you know, you do cyber negotiations, but I don't believe in negotiating and paying ransoms. I said, well, I don't believe in it either. And same thing in kidnapping, I don't pay. And at every opportunity, I will try to avoid paying or minimize the payment. But I think the industry, to a certain degree, says they're doing cyber negotiations, but I question if they're doing cyber negotiations or, based on a business model, doing cyber concessions, which is two different things. And in the kidnapping world that, you know, where I come from decades, we didn't concede, and they never took a day or 5 days, like, you know, the cyber cases, because it was like hardcore negotiations ongoing. And, you know, in the kidnappings, you know, these companies are many bragging that, hey, we get in and out of there within 4 days, and that's our track record through negotiations. Was that negotiations or was that concessions? Because there's a big difference between the two. And I think it goes to the point you're talking about is, hey, it's growing, it's getting bigger, it's getting bigger. Well, perhaps that's why I would suggest is maybe there's a gap in terms of capacity, in terms of having a strategic approach and strategic capacity within these responses that actually leverage the lessons learned and the knowledge from the hostage and from the negotiation stuff in the kidnapping world. And I don't know if it's been leveraged. I know some companies leverage it, but I'm not sure if all companies do. And that's why I think we have a big problem like we do.
I love your distinction between negotiations and concessions. I think that's brilliant. One thing that you spoke about earlier was the need for proxy on state-run hostage discussions and negotiations. When there's a state-run attack, oftentimes they'll find a pre-existing crime syndicate that they'll use as proxy to run that attack. The assumption that I would have in thinking about this is it's almost like you as a state are now going in to train or sponsor some sort of retaliatory force. There's a danger there in the state, in my opinion, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you're training someone who could eventually take you down. Is there a risk to, I mean, obviously they need that separation to have that proxy because they won't want to be seen as the criminal in that case. But is there a risk there that they're using these organizations, training these organizations up to run these attacks, and then there now presents a risk maybe 5 years later that that organization itself is going to hold that own state hostage?
Well, I don't know if there is. There may be, but I would gather, Mark, in these countries that I alluded to, the state monitoring capacity and the threat these states pose to their citizens that step out of line, so to speak.
Step out of line and we'll kill you, basically.
Outside cyber in other areas where, you know, one day you're a street thug / contract killer, and the next day you're being hired by that nation to take out somebody they want, and they allow you to operate within their country and come and go freely as long as you follow the rules of the game and that. So it's like a relationship out of convenience, and they collaborate with each other. So it's not like this, here's the state guys, here's the criminals, but there's a convergence amongst them both. And you see that in cyber. And I think that's super important when you're talking about negotiating with cyber people, because you know, everybody likes to put everybody in boxes. That isn't how the real world of criminality works. So that isn't how the negotiations are going to work. And that's an important part, which we haven't talked about. And maybe I'll turn it back to you, because I think we'll probably get there in this question anyways.
No, the next question I was actually going to have is, when we're thinking about all of this and the evolution of this, you mentioned healthcare and legal as being two big areas that are being hit right now. Do you see a trend in other industries? Is it, you know, healthcare is being a big portion right now, obviously in Canada, but globally, is there one industry that attackers tend to focus on?
I don't know. I just look at the geopolitical situation in the world right now in terms of how we're being polarized in terms of states. And I think the attacks are, yes, they're going to hit corporations for money, and it's going to be a money business, but they're also going to attack to disrupt services, to get research and become more of a national security focused / politically driven incidents. And that money is going to be maybe not the most important thing, but a important thing along with their political objectives, just like kidnapping, you know, where it was, hey, it was a money-making business. And then it shifted, you know, with terrorism to being used for political objectives. And I think, you know, is the same. And there's going to be overlap and convergence between the two networks and groups and activities.
When you're planning and preparing for this kind of a negotiation, what do you consider to be the most important thing that you start with? Or do you plan and prepare differently for these types of negotiations?
So we have different roles with companies right now. One is coaching during incidents, which quite often we get called the last minute and there's no plan in place. But when we do our public education and conferences and speaking and that, and if we get asked for this stuff, one of the things that we always say is to have a plan, to create a response plan for it, to make sure you've, if appropriate, engage with an insurance company for the ransom in advance, engage with, you know, lawyers so that the process has some degree of privilege attached to it due to the sensitivity of it and the legal risk and reputational risk attached to it. And then we say exercise that plan, just like any other negotiation that you're doing. And you know, we were having a conversation, an unrelated conversation before, about, you know, taking courses versus actually dealing with a real live event in negotiation training. And that cascades in terms of planning for, I think, a cyber incident is, I know there's a lot of tabletop exercises and you can take, you know, attend a conference, and I get asked to speak at conferences on this, but really to kind of like really get a good understanding, there's two types of learning. One is a simulation where you actually go through a live simulation that's structured and very sophisticated. Pieces of paper across the table on a tabletop exercise, I don't think gets the emotional aspect of it and gets the human element out of it that much, and exercises it to bring a degree of self-awareness and lessons learned out of it. So I think like exercising it, having the plan and actually exercising it is super critical in terms of the planning of it. So it's one thing to have the plan and it's another thing to exercise it.
Yeah, I mean, if I was the head of risk in a large organization or the head of legal in a large organization, Fortune 500, I would be contacting an organization like yours immediately after this discussion to say, all right, we have no idea what we're doing. And we are at risk, and this risk is increasing in severity and it's increasing in probability, which means that we need to have a plan in place so that if and when this thing happens, we at least have something structured so that we can call you in to run the play, essentially, to be able to help us with this. Yeah. And so would you recommend that if you're a CEO, COO, head of risk, head of legal listening to this right now, would you recommend that there's at least something on paper that shows them the structure of step-by-step what they need to be doing, who to call, when to call, all that kind of stuff?
100% to have a protocol in place. And let me just give a couple quick examples, you know, that highlights some of the failures that I've seen. Number one is paying a ransom. You know, I've talked to law firms about this and people that have facilitated it. And they weren't aware of, just like in the kidnapping world, where, you know, I've learned for 30 years what the risk is. And, you know, my other background being in the money laundering world is once you pay a ransom, particularly, you know, to a proxy or whatever else, it doesn't really matter if everything's okay today. It's what's going to happen tomorrow, 6 months from now, a year from now, in terms of the legal risk, you know, they pose. So when we do other negotiations, there's a lot of risk paying a ransom in terms of implications. And even though you may be sitting, say, safely in country X, country Y, where you have other parts of your business in, may not look at it favorably, and your company is going to be at risk. So I don't think people look at the sanctions issues, the money laundering laws, the terrorist financing issues, because these entities are all interrelated. There's not like black and white between entities. And if people start seeing money in the financial intelligence world moving between entities that you've just paid a $5 million ransom, and it's going to weird places in the Middle East, you know, associated to the proxy attackers, there's going to be some risk. So that's number one. Number two is the operational security. When you do negotiations in a normal business negotiations, there's a degree of security and confidentiality in terms of what your strategy is. But what I've seen often is when you go into a corporation and a lawyer closes his door and says, okay, here's the strategy. He thinks that door and the special term client privilege gives him confidentiality. But all the emails that he's sending, all the phone calls that are being sent, if it's at all state-related attack, are all going to be monitored, are all going to be tracked, not only by friendly countries, but by unfriendly countries. So there is no confidentiality. The only people that you're keeping out of the know is a few people in the office. But you're not keeping the threat actors in the know through a U.S. or a Canadian privileged conversation just because a lawyer is present. And I see it all the time. And I go, guys, like, the threat isn't us. The threat isn't your peers in that. There could be if there's an insider threat, don't get me wrong. So they try to keep it all confidential because I think what they're trying to do is protect the information and the negotiation process to mitigate the reputational risk to their company if they paid a ransom for their clients and partners and that. But what they're failing to know is that the threat actors themselves quite often have the capabilities to listen to their emails and listen to their phones and monitor the whole negotiation process. So they just need to be aware in terms of what we call OPSEC or operational security, that that negotiation bubble is protected in that and not through something called legal privilege, because that doesn't count too much for the bad guys. It only counts for the good guys.
Fascinating. That's fascinating to me. And that would be a mistake that I would make. If I was in the corporate side of things, I would automatically start sending emails to people in the higher levels to say, hey, we got a problem. This is what's happening. Meanwhile, someone's reading all of those emails. They're seeing all of the communication flow. They're mapping out their strategy against your strategy, which is clear as day to them.
I mean, 30 years in the kidnapping world, we presumed everybody was listening to us in terms of our negotiation process. And we took operational security measures to make sure nobody was listening. And that doesn't mean closing an office door. That means like technology being kind of key focus in terms of how you communicate amongst each other and with each other has to be locked down. And I don't think people are looking at that, right? I think they're so focused at the, you know, civil suit that the data got breached and their clients are going to sue them, that that's all they're looking at, because they're corporate lawyers, right? They haven't been out after dark. And the people that have done the kidnapping negotiations and that, we've been out after dark dealing with threat actors like transnational organized crime groups, like terrorist groups, like state actors. And we appreciate how these people act and the threats that they pose to us in the negotiation process.
Amazing. Cal, this is an incredible conversation. If I was a senior level officer at a large corporation, I definitely want to chat with you about this. So to that end, how does someone contact you and where do they find you online?
So two places, probably the easiest. One is LinkedIn, and the second one is our website, Interventus Global, which is a group of security intelligence people where we focus on negotiations and cyber incidents.
Amazing. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you so much for opening our eyes to cybersecurity and the need for negotiation in that world. I am sure that you're going to get a lot of questions out of this because my mind just explodes when I think about all of these different topics. But as usual, thank you so much for being here and sharing your wisdom.
Thanks, Mark. I'm just going to add one point, which I always do on your show. If in that plan you have it and you think you have a plan, my one piece of advice would be have the experts plus one. Bring in that one party or one entity that's outside the response team, that's not part of that response team, to be that third eye, critical analysis. Because I've seen over three decades of people responding to these similar type of incidents that get caught up in terms of the emotional trap and the psychology of, hey, what we're doing is right. But you almost need a third eye in there. And that's something that we advocate and we also provide as a service for entities. And if people don't have that third eye, I think that's a big flag and a big concern.
Speaking of eyes, I need to get you back on the show to talk about the Five Eyes and talk about the risk that that may present. But we'll leave that for another conversation. Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you and have a wonderful day.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you very much for having me.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.